You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As the planet changes, one species may have the social skills to survive. Of course, I'm talking about ants. Mark Moffat is one of the most colorful bug specialists on the planet. His adventures are legion, and yes, Moffat has appeared on the Colbert Report, as well as some obscure publication called the National Geographic. Mark got his Harvard PhD from the dean of ants, really, famed conservationist Edward O. Wilson. He's currently a research associate in entomology at the Smithsonian Institution. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, glad to be here, Alex.
Can you tell us, just to start off, just a couple of your strange adventures as you tracked bugs around the world?
Well, yeah, I like to tell stories that people don't expect, because we hear too much about lions, tigers, and bears, oh my. And the really cool things, the real aliens among us, are sometimes the insects, and they have some of the greatest stories around. So some of my favorites, which I tracked down for the book Adventures Among Ants that's come out, is are the army ants, like the driver ants of Africa, which can have swarms up to 20 million moving. The widest one I've seen is about 100 feet wide, dense with ants, each with little knife blade mandibles capable of cutting human flesh. And so one travels with care in the equatorial Africa region because of those ants. So that's one story. Another one is right here in North America, and that's the story of the slavery ants. And those enslaved ants occur in the ant world only in North America and Europe, and not in the tropics, strangely enough. And I spent some time out there in California, where there's a lot of enslaved ants, and found out why they do it and how they're doing it, and tracked them down in the field, basically.
And is it fair to say that ants have civilizations?
Oh, I think it is fair to say, Alex. The thing is that ants basically form societies in many species that are comparable to ours in numbers, up into the millions. And so that means that they have to deal with the same kind of issues of moving around their resources, of supply and demand, market economies, highways and infrastructure that we have. Many of the things we do, they have to do just because they, unlike any other animal, have these huge societies.
I was somewhat amazed to read about ant agriculture. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, that's one of the most fascinating instances of a parallel, because ants have indeed broken through and created agriculture about 50 million years before we did. They started certain kinds in the Americas, started raising a fungus for food, their version of the morel mushroom, and they are addicted to it. So after many millennia, they eventually they conquered their fungus so thoroughly they domesticated it, so it cannot return to the wild, just as we domesticated our apples and pears and whatnot. And just like our apples, this fungus has little edible tips, fat little things that the ants eat, full of nutrients and goodness. And the ants cannot survive without their fungus, and the fungus can't survive without them. And the agriculture is so thorough in its parallels to humans that the ants have to weed their fungus. They have to keep it extremely tidy. They even apply pesticides to it. Call them anything you think of that we have to do with agriculture, they have to do, and they've done it long before we did.
I think that is just astounding, and we have a lot to learn from them. You know, one of the problems arising from world trade and travel is invasive species. Are ants being redistributed around the world?
Ants are being redistributed around the world at a very high rate. Now, this is, mind you, just a few species. Most ants are actually ecologically extremely valuable. They move more soil than earthworms at a global level. They add nutrients to the soil. They pollinate. They disperse seeds. They do all kinds of things. If we dropped the ants out of our ecologies, it would be much more devastating to the world than humans disappearing. But the ants also have their bad apples, and those include a few species that have become, they're almost human-like in their skills at traveling around the world and conquering everything they meet. And they have gathered those skills in certain parts of the world, particularly, for example, one place I talk about in the book is northern Argentina, where some of the world's worst invasive species come from the same river valley. And the ants there become so skilled at fighting each other that if they get out of there, they basically wipe out anything they touch. And colonies of those ants have invaded the American South in California, the fire ant in the South, and in California it's the Argentine ant. And these are huge colonies with a massive capacity for warfare.
And there is an ant war currently raging in Southern California, you say?
Yes, well, the largest battlefield ever recorded. You know, ants and humans are the only creatures that really have full-bore warfare. And that, again, is because of the scale of their societies. The largest ant societies have a huge excess labor force, as humans have had in some of their big societies. And unfortunately, both our species have often enough channeled that labor into fighting the neighbors. And these ants in California have the largest societies ever recorded. The largest colony contains about 1 trillion individuals, extends from San Francisco all the way down to the Mexican border. Along its borders down in the southern part, it comes into contact with 3 other huge colonies. And along battlefields that go for miles, there are millions of deaths every month right under people's lawns, out of view. You peel back the grass blades and you just see piles of bodies.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound any better than we are, really. So this is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Mark Moffat, author of the new book, Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. Mark, all the species of the world will need to adapt to climate change and other impacts of human civilization. Let's look at how ants are doing. First of all, how long have ants been on the Earth?
Oh, about 150 million years. They arose about the time of the dinosaurs, but they kind of, like the mammals, stayed the underdog for a long time until about the time that the dinosaurs collapsed and the angiosperms, the flowering plants, exploded. And that's when ants really started to reign supreme, just like the mammals did at that time. And so they've been around a long time and pretty essential for much of it.
So they've survived many climate changes. I mean, the time of the dinosaurs was very hot. There was no ice at the poles, we think. Have scientists seen changes in the ants this time around?
Well, ant distributions are often hard to know. Many of the very rare ones that are most likely to go extinct are not studied in the way rare birds are. But clearly, some of them are expanding northwards. Some of them are reaching into Canada now. Americans are just swarming into Canada in the form of ants. And and Europeans, the species are basically, in the case of ants, able to move around the world and often driving up mountains. As temperatures warm, of course, species tend to move up mountains and move up latitudes and drive out the species that were at those higher latitudes and elevations. And so it's really the species of northernmost Canada and the higher mountains, like the Rocky Mountains, that are most likely to go extinct, and those would include ants.
And I've read that some ants have air conditioning systems for their colonies.
Yes, well, this is something that maybe we can hope they develop further to survive global warming. I don't know if ants are capable of thinking that fast or moving that fast, but some of them, in fact, do control their colony temperature and oxygen with precision. Huge leafcutter ant colonies, the ones with this agriculture, with this fungus that I was mentioning, they actually have colonies that go 30 feet deep, and they build their tunnels in such a way that the heat moves through them and out to volcanic-like entrances that can extend several feet in the air to keep the their agricultural fungi nice and oxygenated and cool, and all their babies nice and just at the right temperature, believe it or not.
Well, this may be an offbeat question, but I know that ants have no lungs, so I'm wondering if they could be affected by changes in carbon dioxide levels in the air.
Yeah, well, it's one thing seems to be that higher temperatures end up yielding smaller workers because there's a higher cost of the development of the ants. And this may be one of the reasons why these invasive species do rather well. They're often very small things, like these Argentine ants and fire ants that I mentioned are relatively small ants that boom in numbers and breed very fast, potentially helped out by global warming.
Well, you talk about the multiplication of these species and getting even past ants and into other insects. I understand that some insects will multiply much more rapidly with each degree of temperature rise. What do you know about that?
Well, insects have short generation times and high reproductive rates, so they're more likely to respond quickly to climate change than us long-lived vertebrates, and this is a serious issue for their environmental, their connections with environmental change. For example, there was a recent study of the green stink bug, which is a species that is an agricultural pest of legumes and rice and so forth around the world. And the scientists actually raised some at a slightly higher temperature, 2.5 degrees higher. And after a little over a year, the ones that were raised at the higher temperature became active earlier in the year. They grew more rapidly. They laid more eggs. And they also had more abnormalities because of perhaps the midsummer heat. So insects are probably changing at a very high rate around the world in response to all kinds of condition changes. Of course, global warming is complicated. Sometimes it's not warming. Sometimes it's the amount of water that's the problem.
Yes, absolutely. You get the extreme precipitation events can wipe out colonies of things. So have we been seeing that?
Well, we certainly have been seeing some extinctions, but right now mostly what we're seeing are species moving if they can. Species tend to go, as I said, to higher latitudes where it's cooler and drive other species farther north. And so species are becoming extinct at the southern end of their ranges and moving up north or in a similar way moving up mountains. Some species may be able to adjust their behavior. They often come out earlier than in the year. Of course, the spring arrives earlier, but the problem is many of the species that are critical to the ecology are things like pollinators, and they're going out of sync with their plants. Of course, the flowers have to be blooming when the pollinators are there to fertilize them, and if that doesn't occur, you can have catastrophes. And that seems to be happening around the world with different, for example, butterflies, which are being studied best.
I realize that we don't even really know all the types of insects that are out there yet, but when we think about climate change, what kind of science do you think needs to be done more, and is it starting to happen?
Well, what we have is the potential for a huge database on climate change, and that's available in the museums across North America, where there are millions and millions of specimens collected in the last century. And if we could gather up the data on when they were collected in each generation and see what's happening, we would have a very clear idea of environmental change across this continent. That kind of work would take a lot of funding, but it's certainly something that's going to gradually emerge, particularly with groups like butterflies, which have been well collected for such a long time.
Yes, I wonder whether humans will care enough to realize how fundamental the ants and the other creatures we've been talking about are to our own survival. Are we just going to get all taken up with the economy and the Gulf oil spill? And these things are very important, but, you know, we have a substrata here of insects that are very important to our survival. Are we going to generate enough interest? I think that's something that you do. You generate the interest that perhaps will empower the science that needs to be done to get going.
Yes. Well, of course, even ants need their spokesman occasionally, and they are running the ecology around us unseen and without being paid to do it. And they're doing an amazing amount of work to keep our streets clean and our orchards disease free, and these are the native species. At the same time, we're having to deal with invasive species, which most annoy us, like the ones that invade our homes, and we tend to therefore forget about the good that even an insect like an ant can do, and that's true of the great majority of ant species and insect species.
So we shouldn't be thinking, there's an ant, let's kill it. We should be thinking, there's an ant, we may need that bug.
Yes, I try to avoid stepping on ants whenever possible. This forces me to walk a lot slower in cities like New York than most people walk, unfortunately. But there are ants here and there. The lucky thing about ants is that it's the survival of the queen that matters, as you probably know, Alex. So if you step on an occasional ant, do not feel guilty. She was willing to die for the cause of her colony. The colony survives through the queen and through all those workers that patrol the environment and hopefully, as I say, do positive ecosystem services around North America.
I read in your blog a discussion about super colonies and superorganisms. Can you briefly give us just a slight clue what that discussion is about?
Well, there are two different things. A superorganism is a view that something like an ant colony can be seen as if it was a single organism, like a human body. And that's been an idea treated in a number of different ways, but basically it means that the ants have a very tight identity and affinity for each other, a nationality, if you will, that is so set in stone, they can never, an ant worker can never defect. She is committed, and I say she because ant workers are female like honeybees. She is committed absolutely to her society, and because of that, the group functions very much as a unit in a way that a human society cannot. And those units can grow vast into these super colonies. That's the other word, a super colony, like the invasive species I talked about in California, where the borders can keep expanding until you have millions upon millions upon millions of workers all with the same identity. Amazingly enough, you can take an ant worker from San Francisco and that huge colony I mentioned earlier and drive it all the way down to Mexico and drop it off, and it will merge seamlessly with the other ants there. They're all one giant unified tribe. You carry that same ant a quarter inch over the border in San Diego to the next colony, and it's dead within seconds.
We sort of need James Cameron to bring out a 3D version of life in the ants with, you know, a sympathetic view of what's going on there.
Well, this is the amazing thing, because ants, I did my first story for National Geographic under a lady named Mary Smith, and she got Jacques Cousteau and Jane Goodall and Louis Leakey and many famous scientists started there. And I took my first pictures of ants and showed them to her, and she said, you know, this reminds me of the movie Aliens. These are just so cool. You forget how small they are if you photograph them the right way, and the stories are extraordinary. You know, and I wish someone like James Cameron would talk to us ant guys, because real ants in real life is much more exciting than most science fiction that's been created. The stories out there are extraordinary. We're still finding new ones. People interested, young boys and girls interested in becoming naturalists and working in nature don't have to be stuck in a laboratory. There are great things out there to be discovered.
As we wrap up, is there something else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, the Adventures Among Ants is basically, to pursue that thought, my way of showing that adventures don't need to require a chimpanzee or an elephant. You can have adventures anywhere in the world, even in your backyard. You can find these extraordinary stories, and I believe life is about storytelling, and convey them to each other. And I do hope more young people that love nature pursue it with that sense of exploration that started with Charles Darwin way back in the early explorers, and it continues today. So I look forward to meeting some of you young listeners out there in the future and hearing your new stories about ants.
We have been talking ants with Dr. Mark Moffat, the Wild Man of Entomology. His new book from the University of California Press is Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. It is anything but boring, people, and it makes us reconsider our own civilization. Find out more at adventuresamongants.com. Thank you, Mark, for the big picture on these small creatures.
Appreciate it, Alex.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.